Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Back in 2013, in the New York Times, essayist Christy Wampole declared that we are in a moment of the essayification of everything. She noted how not only the genre, the essay, but also the genre's inventor, Michel de Montaigne, seemed to be popping up everywhere, and she saw the essay as a talisman of our times. Why? What about the essay struck her as so current, so important? Wampole thought that the genre and its spirit provide an alternative to the dogmatic thinking that dominates much of social and political life in contemporary America. The essay is the opposite of the rant, the polemic, the clickbait, the crude headline, and the stupid soundbite. The essay invites complexity, contradiction, nuance, all of those qualities that mark the real experience of our public and private lives. Essays want to reckon with the rich immensity that is in us and is us. Now, if you're like me and feel despair about the degree of dogmatic thinking that now dominates our social and political life in 2017, if you hate the fact that, say, a hastily composed tweet by a recently elected official can clog our public debate and prevent us from addressing issues that demand attention to complexity, contradiction, and nuance, then I encourage you to check out a new collection of essays edited by Marcia Aldrich. It's entitled Waveform, 21st Century Essays by Women, and includes many of the best essayists in America. In essays by Cheryl Strayed, Roxane Gay, Dana Tomasino, and Aldrich herself, the essay achieves its fullest potential, as Wampole described it in 2013. The essay's spirit, she proclaimed, resists close-ended, hierarchical thinking, and encourages both writer and reader to postpone their verdict on life. It is an invitation to maintain the elasticity of mind and to get comfortable with the world's inherent ambivalence. And, most importantly, it is an imaginative rehearsal of what isn't but could be. Marcia Aldrich, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here this morning.
Oh, it's just a pleasure to be able to speak with you. And you have this new anthology that you've put together that I'm looking forward to speaking about. It's called Waveform, 21st Century Essays by Women. You bring a lot of rich history as an editor to this process. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background as a writer. I also know you've done some rich editorial work, some groundbreaking things. So tell us a little bit about the person who comes to this project.
Well, I'd say I have a very varied background. I guess I think of myself as being a writer, an editor, a teacher, and a little bit of a scholar, too. I started out at the University of Washington in poetry and received my MA in poetry writing and then went on for the PhD and specializing in modern poetry. there was no such thing as creative nonfiction or nonfiction. You were either in the poetry side or the fiction side in terms of creative writing. So I'm really sort of self-taught in the sense of what I know about the essay and memoir and all different aspects of creative nonfiction. Started out as a poet and a scholar of poetry, but my own writing changed. And really the writing that I was doing, which I didn't know what to call, was kind of unclassified, veering over into prose and veering over into essay, changed the course of my career. And that doesn't always happen for people. And I was lucky to be in an institution that was happy to accommodate some of the changes that I was going through and became involved in creative writing. But I didn't start in creative writing at Michigan State University. And I became involved in being the advisor for the undergraduate creative writing specialization and the Red Cedar Review, which is the oldest undergraduate creative writing journal in the nation, and became interested in editing and became involved in being the editor for Genre, which Mike Steinberg started at Michigan State and then retired from. So, you know, things happened, and I was able to just call upon whatever expertises I had and bring them to bear, I think, in editing projects, of which Waveform is sort of the culmination of something that probably started a long time ago in the back of my head.
So. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit for listeners that might not know about this genre that you migrated toward. I mean, you know, you've mentioned fourth genre, you mentioned creative nonfiction. These aren't genres that are as familiar as poetry and drama and fiction. So what was it about your own journey that somehow the poem wasn't containing the material and you found yourself pushing into this new domain?
Well, that is absolutely correct. I worked with a poet, a Welsh poet by the name of Leslie Norris at the University of Washington, doing an independent study. And he said to me, I think you are going to write prose. He thought it would be fiction. He said, I think you're just, you know, knocking against the walls of your own poetry. And I thought, no. I'm always going to be a poet. No, I really had a very strong image of myself as a poet. But in fact, he was prescient and saw something in my work. And I became very frustrated with my own sense of the boundaries of poetic decorum. And when I say that, I don't mean that there weren't other poets who perhaps were breaking through, but I wasn't. And the only way that I managed that was to allow myself to just improvise and stop thinking about whether it was a poem or not. And these really explosions of prose sort of came out of me that had been building up and resulted in my first book, Girl Rearing. Many of those pieces were improvisations on a letter of the alphabet. The first one was P, and which ended up not being in the book. But I did have to kind of give myself some freedom, a license for freedom. But I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know what to call it, and was sort of stunned when one of the first pieces I wrote, Hair, was selected in the Best American Essays at the time as an exemplary example of the classic essay. Really, I had no idea that I had fallen into the essay. And maybe it's because the essay really is a very natural form. I absorbed it. without studying it. I simply think I absorbed it from reading, you know, The New Yorker, editorials, who knows what all had been building up in me that allowed me to do this. But I do think it's an extension of some of the poetic training I had.
I want to touch back on something you said about the essay as being a very natural form. And in this case, it's something you kind of naturally fell into. You wake up one day and you find yourself in the Best American Essays, and lo and behold, I am an essayist. There's, I think, another way to think about the essay, the lowly essay that sometimes doesn't get celebrated in the way it should, which is, you know, if you look at the history of poetry, it's a genre that's very interested in artifice. You see it you know, primarily or most explicitly in the formal kinds of poems, from the sonnet to the villanelle or something like that. And then, of course, fiction has its own structures and dynamics. But the essay has always sort of naturally accommodated the way we think and the way we feel. It seems to be a genre that's interested in how it is that human beings actually operate, rather than structures that they build to create beauty or something like that.
Yeah. Although in waveform and as an essayist, once I became a more serious essayist and memoirist and thinking about the genre and the field, I became interested in its ability or its flexibility and lending itself to innovation, to formal innovation, to experimentation, while all along feeling as if it was the form for me that's closest to my flesh, that comes most naturally to me, and almost feels as if I'm speaking to someone, explaining myself to someone. But I don't think that precludes artifice or precludes conscious artistic experimentation. I think they're compatible, but for me, they come together. They work. They're not incompatible the way they were in poetry or pressing upon each other. They work together best for me in the essay.
Well, tell us about the title, Waveform, as a way into this anthology, because I think your title tries to capture many of the things you were just articulating.
Yeah, I am a poet at heart, and so I think in terms of images and concepts that are embodied in images. And so from really the get-go, I had an image of, perhaps one of those Japanese woodcuts where you see a wave being caught, you know, it's on the rise, but you see waves coming behind it. And that was really the catalyst for me, this sense that women's essay writing had been growing. It had been developing, even if we hadn't noticed it or been paying enough attention, perhaps, to what women were doing with the form. But they were, and there was sort of an energy and a momentum that I wanted to capture in the title, that women were influencing other women, sort of encouraging or inspiring other women. And so even if the book could only include 30 essayists, I wanted to give the sense that, you know, behind, beside, underneath, everywhere, there are essayists as powerful and as promising as the ones that are in this book. So I wanted to get that sense of a movement, and maybe also echoes of feminism, waves of feminism. I wanted that not to be explicit, but to be sort of implicitly woven into that. Those were some of my ideas.
I think that it's very interesting what the anthology is not. And just to make more clear what I'm saying, you know, it's not 21st century essays by women, about women, in celebration of women. It's much more concise, right? That it's not an anthology that's staking a clear ideological territory or something like that. It's not thematically driven. You were interested in capturing something, I think, both more exciting and more subtle.
I was very committed to not doing a thematic collection. Or the theme of the collection is, I suppose, more subtle and less marketable, I found out, which was the achievement of women, the array of forms that women are inhabiting and creating in the essay. That was my hook. And that was not commercially viable, interestingly enough. People in commercial publishing really want something that is thematically driven. And I didn't want to do that. And I didn't want to do it for a lot of different reasons. I wanted to give, let's see how to put this. I think women's collections, whether it be poetry or essays or fiction, often are justified and organized around some sort of recognizable or familiar theme. I think women poets have certainly struggled with this. When you study modernism, for instance, the way women were often relegated to certain kinds of thematic material and poetry, and had trouble embracing it, struggling with it. Was it condescending in some ways, or taming them, or domesticating them? I didn't want to do that, and I wanted to give all the women writers a free range in what they wrote about, and let the subject matter fall where it was. I thought that that would be surprising and interesting, because you can't check your gender at the door. So I knew that gender would play a role, but it would not be a dictated one or an explicit one. It would be a surprising one that sort of percolated up through each writer's individuality.
So tell us what's exciting about the idea of thinking about form as an organizing principle. I mean, if you can't get Madison Avenue and the commercial presses to get on board with that, what is it that those of us that care about literature can find in that drive, that attention to form that will excite us and bring us forward into these essays?
Well, that's really the question. And I guess I want to not misrepresent myself as being uninterested in subject matter, because I certainly am interested in subject matter. And readers are always going to be interested in subject matter. I simply didn't want to prioritize that as my organizing principle for this collection. I wanted to sort of relocate the interest in thinking about essays as being idiosyncratic sort of instruments or vehicles in which the rhythms and the colors and the stylistic choices that the writers made in order to realize the subject matter took priority. I think part of that comes from different interests of mine. One is a teacher who teaches a lot of creative writing workshops. I don't teach subject matter. I teach form. Students have the freedom to write about whatever it is they want to write about. I don't dictate what they write about. They may have prompts that are pretty open-ended to help trigger their writing, but the form that they take is really what the writing class is interested in. So I always want a book, a textbook, readers, writing samples for students to see a lot of formal approaches to subject matter. And I thought of this book in the classroom, not only in the classroom, but I do see it as playing, as having a role in the classroom where you can study a spectrum of styles and pay attention to what those choices and strategies and effects mean, and also what you're attracted to as a writer, what speaks to you as a writer that might help advance your own writing. And then I think, again, perhaps because coming from this, from a poetic background, you know, yeah, I'm interested in villanelles and sonnets and free verse and prose poetry. I'm interested in those sorts of formal categories and the work that they do. So I think I brought that to the essay as well.
So when you think about the collection of the essay, what kinds of formal adventures do you imagine the readers of it, you know, what do they get to have? What's going to excite them when they encounter it? Because you can imagine, you know, a listener that might not have a familiarity with the 21st century essay thinking, well, you know, the essay, it's a pretty straightforward genre. You introduce a topic, you develop it, maybe you have a thesis. Form is anything but that in the anthology. So what can we expect to encounter?
Well, first of all, I didn't organize the anthology alphabetically. I came up with my own sort of wave of organization. I tried to put essays next to each other to create certain kinds of, rhythms that went outside the essays themselves, and to imagine sort of the surprise of entering one essay, reading it, and then entering another. Because I do think each of these essays represents, for the moment you're reading, a sort of world, and you enter it. And I wanted it to be surprising and a ride to do that across the time. So I was also looking at trying to represent as much of the spectrum of what I see being published and written in our literary world right now. So I'll take perhaps maybe the most surprising essay in the book formally, which is Tori Peters' Transgender Day, Transgender Remembrance Day, a found essay. I love this essay. I have way too much to say about this essay, but I think perhaps, again, the concept of the found poem or the found art object that Tori takes and applies to the essay and assembles, selects from these documents recording the deaths of various transgender people in the course of a year, and the way she selects and organizes material. She doesn't write it herself, but the writer as an organizer, as a selector, and the power of putting that together and the repetitions and the building of it. It's a devastating essay. I've taught it twice in both classes. We've read it out loud. It's long. It's much longer than Brevity's word limit, which is 750 words. Tori's essay is way, way over that. And when you read it out loud, it's unrelenting. And you go through various peaks and valleys when you hear it. And I taught it both in undergraduate introductory level classes. And while the form might seem difficult or you wonder what's going on, my classes of very young students, this was their favorite essay both semesters. And I think It is very accessible, it's visceral, it's emotional, but yet it's formally inventive. So that's an example, I think, of what I'm talking about, of thinking about the way form represents the content best. So that's one example. I started with Cheryl Strayed's sort of signature essay from Tiny Beautiful Things, because again, it really interests me that she took sort of this old, reliable, familiar, and not very exciting form of the advice column in answering a letter, and takes this epistolary form and this advice column and turns it really into an invitation to write a memoir in the form of a letter, or to write a memoiristic essay that's directed to someone and sort of makes explicit the relationship between the writer and the reader in essay form. It seems like a very straightforward essay. It seems easy, but so hard to do. I mean, that's one of the accomplishments I think about Cheryl Strayed's work, is she makes everything look easy and natural. Try it.
That's absolutely true. It's the hardest thing in the world is to appear completely natural, you know, when you're doing something that is a constructed work of artifice, right? To make it seem as though it's just plain speech, as though it were just being said. It's a tremendously difficult thing to accomplish.
It is. And again, I tried in my classes, and I can't remember if Philip was, your student now in that class, but we did an exercise based on the advice column where we wrote a letter in response to someone asking for help or asking for advice, and tried to turn it into an essay, into a personal essay that both answered the question and took into account the writer, the person who had written us, while still turning it into sort of an essay that could stand on its own. And we found it to be plenty tough. I'll just say that, including myself. I did it with my class. It was very hard.
Well, I am sure that another difficult challenge was to pick 30 essays out of the abundance that you had mentioned earlier that's out there by contemporary women writers. Can you tell us a little bit about the behind-the-scenes construction of this piece, of this anthology, kind of the selection process, how you chose what you chose, who you invited to write original works? I think we've all encountered anthologies, but it would be very interesting to hear, you know, from someone who's made them, how they get done.
It's an excellent question.
I know they're a labor of love.
It is a labor of love. I also think I perhaps would do it a little differently if I was doing it again. Because it was my first time, I'm not sure I saw how to go about it efficiently. And it wasn't like editing a journal, which was the experience I had going into this. Editing for genre, I didn't really recruit essays. For the most part, I was dependent upon the submissions I received. And for genre had a tradition of working with the submissions that came through the door, rather than going out and, you know, recruiting essays from our friends, for instance, or, you know, we didn't aggressively recruit. And that was its philosophy. And I worked with that, except that I was very discouraged, and this does have some bearing on Waveform, in the lack of submissions we received from writers of color. Our submission pool was really just not diverse enough, and it did not give me the latitude to curate issues that I thought were as representative as I wanted them to be. They were very representative in terms of gender. Fourth Genre did an excellent job, I think, in publishing lots of women. In fact, perhaps more women than men. And I know that to be the case. But so I had a certain sort of sensitivity and commitment and motivation that Waveform really needed to do a better job. And to do that, I was going to have to recruit. I was going to have to go out and strenuously look for writers whose voice and identity were going to be more representative of the field. And I did do that. I didn't get all of the writers. Some writers didn't have any work. Some writers just were too busy. I didn't have a complete 100% track record in getting all of the writers I might have wished to have. And I think that's probably par for the course. But I did get a great many writers that I admire. And I wanted to have both well-known writers and writers who I think are excellent, who perhaps are not as well-known. I didn't want it to just be sort of the star system anthology. I wanted a mixture, and I wanted readers to see that there are so many writers who are not well-known, who are, you know, who should be well known, who should be better known. So I wanted that kind of mixture. And I think there's about an equal number of reprints with new material. And that's exciting. I think was a balance that I was aiming for. But it's hard to get writers to give you new work or to write new work for you, for the book. And I was happy to get as much as I did. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does indeed. I'm having some sort of cognitive dissonance. And when I think about all the writers, whether they're on social media or whether there are pieces that come out about, endless slush pile anxiety or submission rejection and all kinds of things, and then to think, you know, here you are extending this invitation, and that isn't something that writers would be embracing. So I think that's where I was a little bit like, it's funny to me that here you are creating this magnificent opportunity to bring together a collection of essays, and here are all these writers out there saying it's so tough, I'm so tired, I'm so worn down by the process, and yet still it's not as easy as one would think.
Perhaps I made a mistake in not deciding from the get-go to just go get reprints. Perhaps if I had approached all the writers and said, I'd like to reprint, you know, this is the essay of yours that I admire so much, and I'd like to have it in my anthology. Would you be willing to do that? Perhaps I would have had more success, but I approached some writers and asked them to do new work because I didn't want it to be all reprints. And that was partly because I started this project, and I should mention this, with Jill Talbot. It came about through conversations with her, and she was thoroughly committed to new work. She thought there was something stale and unexciting and not something she wanted to do, to simply put together, to just assemble the best hits from the last 10 years or 15 years. She thought there needed to be new work, new excitement. And we embarked. That's how we started. She and I, by putting together a huge list of writers we were going to contact, which we did, inviting them to submit. new work. And that was our first gambit. Unfortunately, Jill departed from the project because it coincided with a time in her life when she was looking for a job. She had a temporary job in New Mexico, and things were not going very well. She was on, you know, it was an arduous and stressful time that she was looking for a job, and it was just too much work and too much anxiety to be taking on this project. And I ended up going on by myself.
It's hard to explain to people who see a finished product like this. Oh, look, there are 30 essays. How fun it must have been to assemble it. How much work actually goes into putting something like this together. It's one of those amazing things where once you have the finished project, you think, ah, how nice, how beautiful that I'll get to sit down for a few days and enjoy these essays. And it's hard to imagine the years and the time and the correspondence and the editorial work and the proofing that goes on behind the scenes to put that book in your hand.
Nobody could tell you.
Because you wouldn't do it then.
You really wouldn't, because, you know, you're in charge of getting everyone's addresses. You know, I mean, some of what you do after the book has been accepted is an awful lot of grunt work. Housekeeping, making sure that you've got everyone's contact information and their addresses, and if they've moved, updating it. And the proofing was a nightmare. I'll just say that. The proofing of 30 essayists and our current system of track changes and all that sort of stuff, and various people not being able to handle the programming and stuff, it was a nightmare.
It's true. You don't have to make any apologies. The process is just so arduous and labor intensive. Luckily, the result is beautiful and surprising from essay to essay. And I did notice energy moving across essays. And I like the fact often essays will feel kind of like a hodgepodge of occasional pieces, the anthologies, I'm sorry, the, in which they appear that come together. But here there was a real momentum, as you moved, and I think a sense of attention to even things like length and formal variation that allowed both for reflection for me as a reader, but also a kind of re-energizing, you know, a long piece would be followed by a short lyrical essay that would kind of change the gear for me. And I think that's a different experience that I've often had in anthologies that are organized by, you know, alphabetical order of the author or something like that, or even the ones that are jumbled together by form in some way or theme, mm-hmm. where it starts to feel a little laborious, like here's another essay on home, or here's another essay on travel, and you think, oh, I'm gonna pop around, and this one, that energy you caught in the organization of it.
I hope that's true. And I hope, I'm glad to hear that you noticed that, because frankly, I don't think people notice those things. My first book, nobody, absolutely nobody noticed that every letter of the alphabet was included in the book. It wasn't in alphabetical order, but I had very consciously included an essay for every letter of the alphabet, and not a single reviewer noticed that, which I found disheartening. I'll tell you, I really did. And in this instance, I'm waiting to see if anyone notices that the book opens and closes with a letter.
Well, I think that it might be worth, you told us which essay opens it. Would you tell us which one closes it?
Mine.
Yes.
Which is a letter to my daughter. And I really saw the book opening with this letter to a reader seeking wisdom from Cheryl Stray, and closing with this implicit epistolary form of the letter, of the essay as a letter to my daughter. And it was very conscious on my part. It was something I thought about. And I built the book to get to that final essay and to begin to go back to that final essay. And I do think that there is a momentum. There are certain sorts of like groups of essays that I think build. And I particularly like the way the book ends, the essays that mount towards the conclusion. But I don't know if anyone will notice that. So,
well, I think the strange thing is we can never predict how readers will respond and what they take away and, you know, what connections they make. I've often found the best we can do is give them something as rich as possible. Mm-hmm. And kind of offer it up and hope that they encounter, you know, something that brings them to light. The nice thing about the epistolary form as you use it is that it's very invitational, right? It explicitly invites the reader into the project of the essay, mm-hmm. and so therefore into the book and into the exit of the book.
Oh, well, thank you. Please, you should have put that in my introduction. I mean, I hadn't thought of that, saying it that way, but that's quite right. And, you know, I assumed, because this is how it should be, is some readers will not like everything in the book. That is par for the course. It's part of my expectations that there will be essays that some readers like much more than others. And that is how it should be. I've been happily surprised that the reviewers so far have picked different essays. The first review picked all the big hitters, you know, the recognizable Leslie Jamison, Cheryl Stray, Eula Biss. And they're great essayists and they're great essays in the book. Subsequently, I've been interested in Dana Tomasino's essay, which I think is stunning bit of writing. And I've been really happy for her that essay was Bird Breath Twin Synonym. I think an excellent example of what the lyric essay can do has been chosen, has been singled out, as well as a few other less well-known writers.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes this anthology easy to recommend is that it's 30 introductions to writers that readers might not have encountered in other forums, mm-hmm. especially if they aren't up on what's going on in literary nonfiction. And so there are writers that maybe even people in this world have not encountered. Dana Tomasino is just so talented. And so there is this way in which each of these essays can lead to a body of work that the writer is producing elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think my son was texting me. I gave him the book for Christmas, and he was traveling, and he was texting me lines he liked and images he liked so far, and he picked on Puddling by Jericho Parmes as a particularly wonderful essay. Now, my son is not a literary person in any kind of trained way. He wasn't an English major. He was a science major. And yet, so there's, you know, perhaps we sometimes think that people need to be trained in literary studies in order to appreciate formally innovative essays. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that's true. I think a lot of these essays that are formally innovative are also very accessible.
Yes, so. I think if the form is working, then it should feel organic and just welcoming, which is not to say that it can't be difficult. Difficulty is good. Well, now that you have finished this labor of love, what are you on to as a writer? What are you currently working on, if you wouldn't mind sharing that with us?
No, I'd love to. I wish I was more focused. I started writing a memoir called Haze a couple of years ago, and I have about 200 pages written. And I abandoned it. I don't know that I made a decision to abandon it, but I did. I abandoned it, and I'm looking forward to picking it up again. Which will be difficult because I haven't written in it I haven't written anything new since I moved. I think the last writing I did was last winter in it. I published two pieces from it, two tastes of it. One was in the Normal School last spring, and the essay was called Float. And then this fall, another bit of it was published in American Literary History called Houses of Detention. And I really am sort of desperate to get back into it. It's a straightforward memoir. But on the same token, I'm also working on a book called Tiny Shipwreck that's fragmentary and more experimental and is more essayistic. So I'm sort of spread between those two things. I just had an essay come out in the Kenyon Review online called The Rejection. It just, I don't know, was it last week? And that was gratifying to remind me that I'm still writing essays. And it got picked up by, Longreads as a recommendation. So it seems to be being picked up by some other websites, literary websites, and getting a fair amount of reading play, which is a great honor. And you can't make that happen. Well, you have to write something. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, well, yes, exactly. It's the kind of thing that suddenly a piece bubbles up and you have the pleasure of reading that. So I just wanted to encourage listeners to pop your name into Google and it'll come right up.
Yeah. But you know, it's like the ideal scenario for me as a writer is I write something, I'm somewhat satisfied with it. I send it out. It gets published in a place that is fairly well read. Then other people read it. It gets distributed. You know, that's how it ideally should work. It doesn't always, but it's a happy occurrence. So I'm pretty busy with all different kinds of projects of my own right now.
Well, we will wish you every bit of luck with them. And Marcia Aldrich, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network.
Thank you. I apologize for my cold, impaired voice, but thank you so much, Eric.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Marcia Aldrich, editor of Waveform, 21st Century Essays by Women, on the New Books Network.